are in the midst of relating the tales told by Baruch Batlin to his daughter Rochel, which was later related to her daughter Veraleia about the Maral Prog. The Maral was found himself at a young age in the city of Kroka, and he said that the city of Kroka was indeed magnificent in many aspects. The head of the Jewish community in Kroka at that time was the wealthy and charitable Yisrael Israelis. His son, who was a chaver of the Maral, was a brilliant Rav Moshe, who later became famous as the Ramo. When the Maral and the Marshal arrived in Kroka, the Ramo was then about 18 or 19 years old. They both marveled at his genius. He later became the son-in-law of the Gaon Rav Shalom Shachna of Lublin. The father of the Ramo, Yisrael Israelis, had a base medrash specially built for his son so that he could study there as much as he wished, with every convenience provided him, as one might expect for the son of so wealthy a man. And now these two brilliant students, the Maral and the Marshal, had become friends with him and also studied together with him in the Beis HaMedrash for 3 years. When the Marshal left Kroka, the Maral remained for another 2 years to study with the Rama. In the year 5303, approximately 1543, there was a war in Bohemia. The ruler of Prague waged battle against his neighboring rulers, so the Maral returned home to his family and fiancée. Because her father had become poor, Perel, his fiancée, had bought a food store and thus earned enough to support herself and parents who had, but a short while before, been so wealthy. The Maral was now 32 years old and his fiancée, Perel, 4 years younger than he. So they decided it was time they arranged to get married. The Maral was amazed to find the extent of progress that his bride had made in her Torah studies during the 12 years she had been learning. She was certainly an exceptionally great Torah scholar for a woman. Now that the Maral had returned home and got married, it meant that the store had to provide for a fourth person's living. And as Perel wanted her husband to continue with his Torah studies, she insisted that she would take care of the store and leave him free to study. What mattered to them if they were too poor to afford the so-called luxuries of life? They were happy in their life together, he studying, she working, and studying too after her work was done. The war in Bohemia continued to rage until it reached Prague. One day an armed soldier entered Perel's store and demanded that she give him bread and other foodstuffs, loading everything into his carriage. When she asked for payment, he said that he had no money with which to pay. Perel explained to him that this store was all she possessed, and the only means she had of making a living for herself and family. The soldier was not a bad-hearted fellow and was moved by her words, and so he asked her to accept a tunic beautifully embroidered as a pledge, saying, "If I fail to return within the next 2 or 3 days, then this garment is yours." Days passed, and the soldier did not appear. "In worn times," said the Maral, "many people hide their jewels in such garments. Let's investigate this tunic." So Perel ripped open the lining, and there, sure enough, was a quantity of precious stones. They waited for a further period, and as the soldier never came back, they were entitled to keep the garment, as he had told Perel. In any case, they had no idea who he was, nor who were his relatives. Thus the Maral, his wife Perel, and their parents were again on their feet, and Perel's father could begin to think of doing business again. When the war was at an end, Perel's father, Shmuel Reich, took over an order from the government to supervise the rebuilding of the city's property, which had suffered damage as a result of the war. He carried out the job entirely satisfactorily, was well rewarded, and soon became quite well-to-do again. Shmuel Reich now gladly distributed the charity with a lavish hand, and the Jewish community of Prague again looked to him for leadership. As for the brilliant Maral, he was now able to continue his studies without worrying about the burden his wife had to shoulder in order to support him. Now, even Perel could feel free to sit and study. Every day she had a lesson with her husband. Not only did they study Gemara together, but also ethics and metaphysics. Perel used to say that since she was 8 years old, never a day passed but that she studied for at least 5 hours. Later, when she married the Maral, various communities used to send him questions on their problems. It was she who would read out these letters to him and then write out his replies. She arranged and edited all of the Maral's literary works. It is told in no less than 8 places she found errors in her husband's writings, misquotations of one of the sages or of Rashi. The Maharal was very pleased and praised his wife for pointing out these errors. He applied to her the quotation which says, Rabbis Bonis, Oshachoyel Vatolis Okulona, many daughters have done well, but you have surpassed them all. Perel presented her husband with a son, Bezalel, and three daughters, Rachel, Tila, and Rayalina. Bezalel had a very good brain and grew up with a wonderful talent as a master. He could so beautifully explain to his pupils, Rabbi Ephraim Lunkis, the author of Eilus Ephraim, was appointed head of the yeshiva in Prague. Sir by Bezalel had married the daughter of a well-known distinguished Jew who had provided him with his needs for nearly 13 years, betook himself and his wife to Cologne and established the yeshiva there. This yeshiva later became very popular and famous over a wide area. Rabbi Bezalel had two sons, Menachem and Shmuel, and a daughter named Lift. The older son, Menachem, died in infancy. Shmuel was a gifted child, but had no inclination for study. He had a beautiful handwriting, could paint most artistically. He was especially clever at all kinds of handwork, particularly in engraving metals such as gold, silver, and copper. When Shmuel was 16 years old, he wrote out a Torah scroll on parchment, a handbreadth and a half long, and just under a handbreadth wide. The script was clear and flawless, and according to the din. The words were so small, however, that it was necessary to use a magnifying glass in order to be able to decipher them. Shmuel also made for the scrolls wooden rolls, which were beautifully carved and which bore the following quotation, and this is the law which Moshe set before the children of Israel, according to the commandment of the Lord by the hand of Moses. It's the tree of life, Yitzchaymi, Drachel Drakinoyim, Erechim Bimino, and so on. Shmuel then had a yad, a handle made for this miniature Sefer Torah, and carved out certain quotations from the Torah on it. Also a picture of the crossing of the Red Sea, showing the Egyptians drowning and the Jews being saved. Shmuel also had a silver crown made for it, and engraved on it the scene where the Jews were given the Torah on Mount Sinai. Shmuel further showed his artistic talent by making a miniature holy ark to hold his miniature Sefer Torah and crown. This ark was carved out of ebony and was all in one piece. On the west side of this tiny ark, he had engraved a picture of the Holy Temple. On the south side of the ark, he had engraved a copy of the copper altar. On the north side, it was a table with the lechem upon them, the showbread, and on the eastern side were the two small doors of the Holy Ark with the two tablets engraved. On the outside of the ark, he had cut out a picture of the Holy Ark, and on the inside, he had engraved the menorah and the golden altar. With all this, the young artist was still not done. He obtained a piece of white marble and hewed out an opening large enough to take his ebony ark and added to this a stone curtain. On this marble ark, he engraved a picture of the destruction of the temple and a scene depicting the Jews wandering about in exile. Then another scene showed Chan and her seven sons giving up their lives for their religion. Another picture shows a Jew with a bundle on his shoulder, a stick in one hand and the Sefer Torah in the other, as a symbol of the Jew in exile. When Shmuel was 19 years old, his father married him to the daughter of a well-known leader and philanthropist from Germany named Mordechai Saltscheid. The wedding took place in Prague at the home of his grandfather, Maharal, who was then 83 years of age. Shmuel had brought his work of art with him, and when he presented his miniature Sefer Torah with its ark to the Maharal, the Maharal was delighted with his grandson's masterpiece. Shmuel's father, Bezalel, died in Cologne in the year 1600, and Shmuel then moved to Prague. While he was in Cologne, Shmuel earned his living by dealing in gold and silver and precious stones. His main source of income was derived from selling precious stones and pearls and other adornments. In Prague, he continued this business in handicraft, specializing in his engravings in colors on metal. He managed thereby to amass a considerable fortune. While, as we have noted, the Maharal became famous in Prague and throughout the Jewish world for its wealth of Torah knowledge and saintliness, the father-in-law of the Maharal, Shmuel Rayach, reached an elevated position in the economic field and had close contacts with royalty. The ruler of Prague at that time was Ferdinand I. Shmuel Rayach was a great favorite of his because of his intelligence and great ability. This naturally aroused much jealousy and hate among the courtiers, who could not bear to see a Jew attain so high a position in the eyes of their ruler. These people plotted and planned how best they could bring about the Jews' downfall. So they brought slanderous stories about him to Ferdinand, but much to their grievous disappointment, Schmulrat's position remained unassailed. King Ferdinand was a devout Catholic, and if at first this did not influence him against his friendship, the Jewish Schmulreich, there came a time when the king's mind, too, was poisoned against Jews. The year 5316, which is 1556, approximately the Catholics in Rome experienced their victory over the Jews by publicly burning their treasures of literature, their precious books. When this Inquisition triumphed, its spirit spread also to other Catholic countries. This spirit of Inquisition began to infiltrate into King Ferdinand's court in Prague. The Catholic fanatics began an incitement against the Jews, and the king gradually fell under their influence. A year later, he called the heads of the Jewish community and informed them that he could no longer afford them his protection. It was therefore in their own interest to leave the countries of Bohemia, Moravia, and Silesia. Silesia. Schmulreich knew which courtiers would be vulnerable to accepting bribes, and was prepared to give away his whole fortune if it would only help the Jews and save them from being so ruthlessly driven out of their homes and their native countries. But before taking any such steps, Schmulreich decided to discuss the question with his brilliant son-in-law, the Maral. The Maral advised against such a plan, being opposed to the idea of buying out Jews, as he saw a danger in it becoming an incentive to similar measures elsewhere. At that time, Prince Ferdinand of Bohemia, the son of the king, paid a visit to Prince Johann of Moravia. They were both deeply interested in astronomy, and together came across a very important mathematical problem to which, try as they would, they could find no solution. They approached their scholarly experts on the subject, but they could not help them. The two princes then made a bet, saying that whichever would be the first of them to find a solution to the problem they sought should become the spiritual master of the other, who would become a spiritual slave. They allowed themselves 6 months' time in which to carry out the bet. Now, apart from his own estates, Prince Ferdinand was the heir of a certain prince in Bohemia who was childless. This inheritance was comprised of castles, villages, townlets, flour mills, weaving mills, inns, and so on. The manager of these estates was a certain Jew from Prague named Mieczysław Sobol. He had been held in the highest respect and esteem by the previous owner, as also by the present owner, Prince Ferdinand. After his bet with the Prince of Moravia, Prince Ferdinand paid a visit to the aforementioned estates, of course met the manager, Mieczysław Sobol. Manager remarked that he noted with regret that the prince appeared to be rather worried. Was there any way in which he might be of service in the matter? The prince then related the story of the bet, which naturally weighed heavily on its mind. I see you have approached your scholars, but you have not yet tried the Jewish scholars, remarked the manager. The prince burst out laughing. What do Jews know about such subjects? He retorted contemptuously. All they can do is wail about destruction of their holy temple. They can also dream about their redemption, which will supposedly come about by means of some miracles. But what do they know of scientific matters? Mieczysław Sobol had known the prince since he was a child, and so took the liberty of speaking to him frankly. You have a completely wrong conception of Jews, and of course the fault lies with the one who has been responsible for your training. He was the enemy of the Jews, and because of his hatred to them, he told you many things about them which are entirely false. Certainly true that we bewail destruction of our holy temple, and it's equally true that we look forward in faith to our future redemption at the hands of the Almighty. But that is not to say that we have no great scholars and no great scientists. If you wish to hear the opinion of a great scholar, why, you have one of them right near you, in the person of the Rav of Prague. There is not a science of which he has not the most expert knowledge, exclaimed Mieczysław emphatically. If you really believe that the Rav of Prague can solve my problem, then bring him to me by all means, said the prince, for I ask that the matter should be arranged secretly, for if it became known that Prince Ferdinand had need to resort to such a low and wild people as the Jews to help in solving a scientific problem, everyone would laugh at me. The prince spoke these words in a friendly tone, and it was obvious that he did not realize that he had said anything which might offend the Jewish manager, but Mieczysław nevertheless felt deeply hurt by the ignorance and slight of the prince's words, and said to him with feeling, My lord, if I did not know you to be fair-minded and just, well-mannered, and good-hearted, I would take your words to mean that you judge people by hearsay and not by your own understanding and reason. The matter becomes still more grave when we consider that it is in reference not only to one individual, but to a whole people. But why should you speak thus of Jews when you do not know them? You have no knowledge of their mode of life, of their culture. It's not you who speak, however, but the voice of hate of your priests and other enemies of Israel. Moshe Yitzchak continued to explain to the prince that he was being misled completely by his priests, who could not bear the thought that the Jews adhered to their faith and that they stood on a higher plane morally and intellectually than themselves. And how do you come to refer to the Jews as low? Is it because they are ready to do all kinds of work, if only honest, in order to make their modest living? Continued the manager. Why, too, do you call them wild? Can it be that because they spend most of their available time in Torah study and divine service? Who else is as industrious as the Jew? Who else follows such a pure family life as a Jew? Who else spends the Sabbath and holy days in so spiritual a manner as a Jew? Here the prince interrupted to put in what he considered some justification for his criticism. Jews are all rich, he said, and money means everything to them. Moshe Yitzchak Sobol saw that he had better explain to Prince Ferdinand how false was this contention. He told him that among the Jews, in all probability, had more poor people among them than others, but their moral training was such that they lived carefully, not extravagantly, with an eye towards the day when they would need some extra money. That is why they were saving-minded, with ambition for their children's education and future. Another reason why the non-Jews would not be aware of any poor among Jews was that the richer Jew was always ready to help his more unfortunate brother, and so they never appealed to non-Jewish sources for financial assistance. All these reasons might lead the unobservant and disinterested non-Jew to come to the conclusion that there were no paupers among Jews. In contrast, the non-Jew was a spendthrift and drank away his earnings without a thought for the morrow. Moshe Yitzchak further pointed out to the prince how many Jewish laborers worked hard and conscientiously to make a living and be able to pay their taxes to the government. And yet you ignore all these things, and in your eyes you find the Jew a lowly and wild people, the manager concluded, with tears springing to his eyes. The prince appeared moved and lowered his head. The manager took advantage of the opportunity to say to the prince, "Can you not appreciate our great tragedy? Is it not enough that we have been driven out of our land and have lost our independence? And now we must wander from land to land, giving our strength to the countries in which we find ourselves and work hard to fill foreign treasuries? Then we are rewarded by having everything taken from us and being turned out of the countries which we have been living just as if we were criminals. Now it has been decreed that we leave Bohemia, Moravia, and Silesia, where we have lived for hundreds of years and have brought much wealth to these areas. Yet, instead of complaining, we beg God to forgive us for not serving him as we should. Otherwise, we feel he would not have allowed such a punishment to befall us." The manager then poured out his heart to the prince, pointing out to him the injustice being perpetrated against the Jews. Moshe Yitzchak's words made a profound impression upon Prince Ferdinand. He had for some time known of intrigues going on in the royal court at the hands of the priests, but he knew that his father, the king, was helpless in their hands and could not do anything against their incitement of the Jews. The manager's words therefore struck home, and the prince became lost in thought. A few days later, the prince called the manager and asked him to bring the Rav of Prague, the Maral, to him, as the bet he had with the Prince of Moravia was weighing on his mind. "Forgive me, my lord," said Moshe Yitzchak, "but I cannot possibly go to this great scholar and saint and say he must come with me to you. I must first ask him if he is prepared to do this." The prince was not offended, but took it in good part. In fact, he showed a great interest in this man called the Maral, wanting to know all about him and how he came to be the rabbi of Prague. He also intimated that he would like to hear something of other great men of Israel. Moshe Yitzchak took the first opportunity to call on the Maral and tell him of the prince's request. If he were willing to go, the prince would send a special carriage to bring the prince to the castle. The Maral agreed to go to the prince, but refused to drive in the prince's carriage. He believed it would be better if he drove in an ordinary carriage. Before a week had passed, the Maral had called on the prince, who told him of the mathematical problem with which no one seemed to be able to solve. To the great delight and surprise of the prince, the Maral wrote thrown out the solution without hesitation and without any apparent effort. The prince wanted to reward the Maharal for having helped him in this matter, which had meant so much to him. But the Maharal declined, saying that it is an accepted custom among Jews since the time of Moses to impart knowledge to others without remuneration, only accepting when people did this as a means of earning their living. The prince took a great liking to this remarkable Jew, who seemed to know so much about every conceivable subject. The Maharal stayed about a week at the castle, or rather at the house of Mish Yitzchak Sobel, visiting the prince at the castle every day and spending several hours with him discussing all sorts of scientific matters. The prince took the opportunity of learning all he could about Jews, their mode of living, their belief and faith, their history. The prince was astonished at the great breadth of knowledge displayed by the Maharal. "How is it that you know so much about natural science?" he once asked the Maharal. The Maharal explained to him that actually all these sciences can be learned in our Torah, and in order to be a good Jew, one has to study them all. He further explained to the prince that it was a Jewish tradition to hand down from generation to generation the Torah and everything connected with it. When the 6 months, which the princes had agreed upon in connection with the bet, were at an end, Prince Ferdinand invited the other prince, Prince Johann of Moravia, to come to his castle. He also invited the bishop and other high-ranking clergy, among whom was his brother Prince Maximilian. When all were assembled, Prince Ferdinand proudly announced that he had the solution to the mathematical problem, and when he read it out to them, everyone was astounded at the answer, which contained such a depth of wisdom and knowledge. "But please don't think that it was I who am responsible for discovering the answer to this problem," said the prince, not wishing to deceive them, nor to take the credit for something he did not deserve. "It was given to me by someone whose name I have promised I would not divulge." Now, later what happened about this decree where the Jews were supposed to leave these three countries, Emir Tzeshem, in the next and final installment of the story of Rav Baruch Batlan and the stories told by Rav Baruch Batlan.